Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studio of Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, August 17th, 2017. I'm asking you to please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. Let us start off with announcements. The habitat restoration team of the California Native Plant Society is having a restoration this Saturday, August 19th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. They'll be at Baldwin Creek in the Wilder Ranch State Park. They're returning to the sweet spot for removal of various mustard species and a follow-up on Cape Ivy control. Linda says she'll see you out there. How to get to Wilder Ranch? We'll take Highway 1 through Santa Cruz to the north and continue to the turnoff on the left-hand side for Wilder Ranch. Watch for the sign indicating a left turn. When you get to the State Park kiosk, let the person there know you're volunteering with the Habitat Restoration Team, and they will give you a parking pass. Meet them at the interpretive sign by the bathrooms in the parking lot. Once again, that's this Saturday, April 19th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Wilder Ranch State Park. The California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team is an all-volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore those special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Please wear comfortable layered clothing and bring something to drink and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine or fog, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring your gloves and your water. For more information, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number is 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. Or you can email her at redwoodrn, that's REDWDRN, at pacbell.net. Or you could visit their website at www.cruisecnps.org. And help the Buffalo Field Campaign prepare for the winter. Join them for their annual Woodcut Week, September 1 through 4. It's hard to imagine right now that winter is not very far away, but it comes quickly to Yellowstone Country. And not too long from now, the home fires will be burning. At the Buffalo Field Campaign, wood is our only source of heat for the living quarters, and it takes a lot to keep our many lodges heated. Much of our wood has been gathered, cut, and stacked, but we still have a ways to go, and we need your help. Their annual Woodcut Week is September 1st through the 4th, and we welcome you to join us. Come help the Buffalo Field Campaign finish our wood gathering for the upcoming season. Buffalo Field Campaign cannot exist in this cold climate without our wood, and it is a tremendous amount of work to get it all in. Mike, Pat, Don, Hamney, Greg, Scott, Daniel, and Nick have done a lot already, and they sure could use some extra hands. If you like hard work and hauling large logs, please come help. Lots of board will provide it, along with the room. So if you have your own chainsaw, bring it along. And if you're coming, please write to Mike at the Buffalo Field Campaign. All right, and the more the merrier. We thank you, and once again, that webpage is www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, and you'll find the email address for Mike there. And Trout Unlimited is asking you to volunteer to enhance trout habitat on the Little Truckee River coming this Saturday, August 19th. Come join the Truckee Trout Unlimited chapters. We help place spawning gravel in the Little Truckee River to help benefit all of our proactive trout. Bring along some friends, bring some buckets, shovels, and your best wading gear, and let's give the trout a little incentive to keep the Little Truckee a wild trout fishery. Afterwards, they're going to have some suds available so that they can celebrate all that they accomplished for our cold waters. Where to go? Well, meet them at the Little Truckee River parking lot just below Stampede Dam, and that's north of Lake Tahoe on Saturday, August 19th at 9:30 in the morning. Once again, that's the Little Truckee River parking lot below Stampede Dam at 9:30 on August 19th. If you're coming or you have questions, give Sam Sedillo a call, and his email is ssedillo@tu.org, or his phone number is 408-718-9897. That's 408-718-9897. Please let him know you're coming. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife wants to remind all fishermen that the fall Chinook season is closed on the Klamath and Trinity Rivers. You can still fish for steelhead. Due to historically low stock projections of the fall Chinook on the Klamath Basin for 2017, a full fishing closure was adopted by the California Fish and Game Commission. The fall Chinook fishing season is defined as August 15th through December 31st on the Klamath and September 1st through December 31st on the Trinity River. All Chinook incidentally caught during these respective dates must be immediately returned to the river. However, steelhead fishing remains open in those designated areas. Just a reminder, the daily bag limit is 2 hatchery steelhead, and position limit is 4 hatchery steelhead. Hatchery steelhead can be identified by a healed adipose fin clip. That is, the adipose fin is absent, and that's on the tail end of the steelhead. All wild steelhead with an intact adipose fin must be immediately returned to the water if you happen to catch one, and please consult the 2017-18 Supplemental Sport Fishing Regulations for further information on open areas and gear restrictions that may apply. If you need further information, go to www.wildlife.ca.gov. And Deer Liberation Front attacks the Fribourg Agricultural Institute in France in this story from Renverse, as found on the Earth First Journal. The Deer Liberation Front attacks. On the night of August 6th, the gratings of a breeding farm of the State Agricultural Institute of Fribourg were cut, and about 100 deer were able to escape and find refuge and relative freedom in the forest. These animals, whose ancestors live in the wild European forest, were kept in captivity at the Sorens farm, where they were destined to be killed for their meat or sold for the renewal of blood in many farms. This type of liberation and sabotage action, which is fairly easy to implement, makes it possible on one hand for individuals to escape confinement and certain assassination, and on the other it leads to significant economic losses for those responsible for animal exploitation. We attack the Agriculture Institute of the State of Fribourg, a state structure deeply involved in the oppression of human and non-human animals and in the destruction of the environment. In addition to dealing with various commercial farms, deer, cattle, and milk marketing, fattening, and the sale of pigs, this institute also has a research function for experimentation in animal production, education and training for breeders, in addition to being one of the main actors in the perpetuation of livestock breeding in Switzerland. The Agriculture Institute of the State of Fribourg is clearly part of the crushing policy pursued by agribusiness against small peasant farmers who strive to practice autonomous agriculture without destroying the land. This is expressed in particular through a partnership with Agriscope, a federal competence center for agricultural research, which is the main Swiss actor linking scientific research with the agro-food sector and acting in favor of the introduction of genetically modified organisms in Switzerland, in particular by managing the field of genetically modified organism experimentation in Reichenholz. Let us be many who fight against those who organize the destruction of the planet and the exploitation of those who are the people. And 2 bull buffalo are dead after migrating into Idaho. Things aren't always quiet in the field during the summer. While the majority of the buffalo can be found within Yellowstone in and around the Lamar and Hayden Valleys, occasionally some bulls make their way into the Hebgen Basin near West Yellowstone or even into Idaho. On August 1st, we received a call first thing in the morning that a bull had been spotted along Highway 20 near Henry's Lake Flats in Idaho. The Idaho border is about 15 miles from West Yellowstone and very close to the South Fork Denny Creek area, which we frequently report about. Pat and I got our gear together and hit the road to search for this bull. Idaho does not welcome any wild buffalo from Yellowstone, and in fact has a law designating wild buffalo as outlaws. Every summer, it seems, a bull slips through unseen, ends up in Idaho, and winds up dead. After pulling the trigger, Idaho's typical response is, "We don't have wild bison in Idaho." When we got to Idaho to the bull's last known location, we were frustrated as trying to locate a single bull on that vast landscape. It was like trying to find a needle in a haystack. As we pulled over, looked around, and wondered what to do, the local Montana Department of Livestock inspector Bridger drove by, saw us, and pulled over across the road. We headed over to learn what he knew, and he said that no one had been able to find the bull. Idaho Department of Fish and Game knew he was around, but not exactly where. During our conversation, we discussed another bull who had tried to make it to West Yellowstone, and he let us know of two additional buffalo who had moved through the Madison Arm Road to the South Fork Denny Creek area. One of these bulls got in with some cows belonging to Pat Pova, a local hobby rancher who is staunchly anti-buffalo. That has always been a death sentence for bulls, but not this time. Bridger said he had moved the one bull out of Pova's cows and then hazed both of them to habitat where they are safe. We were shocked that the bull hadn't been killed. Just like when a bull makes it to Idaho, every time a bull gets to Pova's in the summer, they are shot. We thank Bridger. He let us know that the Montana Department of Livestock is trying not to use lethal methods as much as possible, which was also surprisingly shocking to hear. Bridger said he would also let us know if he heard anything about the bull now in Idaho. Our heads spinning in disbelief that we just had that conversation, we parted ways. We continued to look for the bull, but had no luck. Bridger mostly kept his word and for a few days let us know that no one had found him yet. Then on Saturday, it was reported in a local paper that a family on vacation had found a bull buffalo with their vehicle. He was struck and killed on Friday night. The sad part is that striking the bull was buried in the article, which was written with a focus on the family's two-legged dog who had been lost after the collision but later found unharmed. When we contacted Bridger about this incident, he informed us that this was yet another bull because on the day before, on Thursday, he had found the guy we'd been looking for and said he took care of him. When we asked if he shot him, he fell silent. We can only assume that is what happened. But the odd thing is, why would a Montana livestock official out of his jurisdiction in another state shoot the bull when he was in Idaho? Questions remain, but the sad reality is that two wild migratory buffalo who attempted to restore themselves to their native habitat are dead. While buffalo have been extirpated from Idaho for more than a century, that they would not gain immediate protection or at the very least be celebrated for making a return is a sad testament to what this nation holds or doesn't hold sacred. And in the United Kingdom, over 100 hunt saboteurs disrupt the inglorious 12th grouse hunt in the story by the Hunt Saboteurs Association. Over 100 hunt saboteurs from around the country descended on the moors of Yorkshire in the Peak District yesterday to disrupt the first day of the grouse hunting season. They first stopped to shoot on the notorious Saddleworth Moor before moving south to the Fitzwilliam Estate in the heart of the Peak District and preventing an afternoon of shooting. The police attended both incidents but appeared to have little interest in enabling the shooters to continue. The Glorious 12th is the highlight of the shooting calendar, and shooters pay thousands of pounds for the privilege of blasting birds out of the sky. The shooting estates claim that they maintain the grouse moors, but the reality is that, although picturesque, they are a barren wasteland. Natural predators such as foxes, stoats, and birds of prey are shot and trapped in large numbers. Mountain hares are killed as they carry ticks that may affect the grouse, and the grouse themselves are heavily medicated as their unnaturally high levels allows disease to spread. By the end of the grouse shooting season in December, over 500,000 birds will have been shot. Lee Moon, spokesperson for the Hunt Saboteurs Association, stated, "Well done to the hunt saboteurs who stood between the guns and the grouse yesterday. There is currently a groundswell of protest against the shooting industry in the United Kingdom. For years they have hidden behind their flimsy claims of conservation, but this mask has now slipped and the reality of this cruel sport has been exposed. Not only are hundreds of thousands of grouse killed each year, but any potential predator is wiped out by armed gamekeepers who shoot, trap, and poison all the other species on the grouse moors. Yesterday, the moors, we didn't see a single bird apart from grouse all day. Their beauty disguises the grim reality of these barren, killing fields. And 2 days of blockades and actions in Poland's primeval Białowieża Forest, in this story from the Hombok Forest, as found in the Earth First Newswire. The logging of the ancient Białowieża Forest has been blocked and equipment occupied for 2 days in a row now. On Thursday, a group of activists locked onto the harvester and the forwarder, resulting in the longest logging. Longer blockades of equipment parking spots of several days have taken place, but this blockade lasted over 9 hours. Next day on Friday, over 15 people locked on in a chain and were joined by an additional 30 people forming a road blockade in front of trucks carrying over 130-year-old spruces out of the forest. The oppositions to this wanton destruction of the last ancient forest in Europe has recently heated up and received additional support after the European Court of Justice made a ruling calling on the Polish government and its environmental ministry to immediately cease logging of a 100-year-old part of the stands of continental forest. The government, in turn, is now attempting to employ an arbitrary loophole by heavily cutting next to roads and claiming that it is done for safety. At the moment, old growth trees are being cut as far as twice the height of the crown from the road. The response of the camp in defense of the forest has been establishing of daily patrols, searching and locating logging activity, and monitoring the location of endangered species, many of which are listed as both endangered and protected by both the Polish and European authorities. Still, it is only grassroots self-organized actions that have been able to affect the logging of this biodiversity hotspot. The classic cat-and-mouse tactics employed by the world over by eco-activists infiltrating logging sites has seen the reversal of roles in Białowieża, as is now the activists who have taken the roles of the cat, with the large equipment and operators attempting to flee the scene as soon as activists show up. This has not prevented a group of over 8 activists last Thursday from chasing and locking onto a harvester in the early hours of the morning. They were divided into those with lock-on metal pipes covered with isomats, and a second group who carried only rolled isomats, which looked as if they contained pipes. The group carried the decoys was lighter and went ahead and was intercepted by about 4 or 5 forest guards, who then detained them and proceeded to take their personal information and issue fines for trespassing as the second group locked onto the harvester. The harvester, however, continued to drive away from the cutting site, with 8 people having climbed on top and hanging from its sides. Some were being dragged on the ground. This continued for about 100 meters and was only stopped by a person standing in front of the machine. The 5 foresters on the scene were then joined by 1 or 2 more who were blocking the surrounding roads. About an hour elapsed before more than 30 people joined in. Attempts to negotiate by offering to stop cutting for the day if people unlocked were made. The response was discussing the possibility of forestry employees going on a strike and engaging in local folk singing, a result of in the camp workshops of the previous instances, the media and recording devices were taken away, so an attempt was made to climb a tree next to the harvester. Unfortunately, a fence in between was quickly pulled down and the activist grabbed by a foot, being pulled while hanging on a waist tape which was eventually reached and cut. The silver lining of this situation is that the same activist, when being ID'd and fined for trespassing, was able to jump on a forwarder maneuvering around parked police and forestry vehicles. The all-terrain forwarder with a grabber works in tandem with the harvester, cutting and loading over 200 to 400 trees a day. The other vehicle, being blocked and stopped by climbing on top of its loading arm, drew the guards from the harvester, allowing those locked on to reposition themselves into better locked-on positions. The vehicles were separated by 100 meters, allowing for visual support. The forwarder was kept running, vibrating and at times stuttering, violating all workplace regulations that call for stopping of all dangerous equipment when people are in the way. After the grabbed arm was lowered and the climber pulled down the forwarder, it drove back to the harvester and was used to access and pull down three people sitting on the cab. When the forwarder backed up to the still locked on activist with its exhaust going full blast, attempting to smoke out and poison those still attached. Futile attempts were made to disassemble the parts through which the pipes were attached. Some bracelets were reached and cut by pulling the arm out of the shorter pipes. One of the locked on activists in a pair was pulled through a small opening. Another was attached to a round closed hook that was cut. Two pairs were then carried, still locked on together, by seven cops and then served fines for trespassing on a restricted forest area and then left in their car. This blockade resulted in cutting starting at 3 a.m. the next day, and when the new group showed up, all the equipment quickly left the forest. Later in the day, patrols spotted trucks loading on the wood and taking it out of the forest. The new blockade was organized and was set up on a road next to a parking lot, resulting in a large traffic of hikers and bicyclists offering their constant support and often clapping. When the forestry goons finally masked up several hours later, they walked past the blockade when the cops were also on the scene checking IDs and walked to and surrounded the truck behind the barricade. The truck was backed out into the forest while it was surrounded by 50 guards, while cops were busy trying to prevent journalists from filming and recording the notices and citations they were being issued. When the groups returned back to camp, they were met with additional supporters offering support in the form of food, supplies, and their energies. And the Sea Shepherd vessel is being tailed by corporate fish farm boats in Western Canada in this story from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Norwegian-based Marine Harvest, which owns numerous salmon farms occupying the coastal Pacific waters in Canada, appears to be sending local employees to tail Sea Shepherd while the nonprofit conservation group conducts its wild salmon defense campaign, Operation Virus Hunter 2. Sea Shepherd's vessel, the RV Martin Sheen, is currently off the coast of British Columbia with independent biologist Alexandra Morton, stopping at various salmon farms to conduct audits for disease and other factors. Recent discoveries include tens of thousands of wild herring trapped in post-harvest salmon pens belonging to Marine Harvest and Cermaq. Late last week, after hearing rumors of die-offs at nearby salmon farms, Sea Shepherd was keen to investigate. The crew woke to find a skiff belonging to Marine Harvest waiting in the distance for the RV Martin Sheen to begin sailing. They followed us all the way to the farms, and when we got there, they tied their boat back to the farm to observe us and filmed us collecting water and bottom samples near the farm, said campaign leader Carolina Castro. When the day was done, they followed us again to see where we spent the night so that they could warn of nearby farms of our impending visits. This has been the same routine on almost a daily basis. There are die-offs at fish farms that are common in the salmon industry and can occur when the farmed fish get sick, as the pens are an aquatic version of factory farming that is a breeding ground for diseases and parasites. When farmed salmon are packed so close together, mass contamination of the pens is unavoidable. When large quantities of Atlantic salmon start dying, the workers use divers and pumps to pull the dead fish out of the water. The rotting fish are collected in bins and transported in barges to a nearby location. Sea Shepherd reported that when it witnesses workers pulling the dead Atlantic salmon out of the pens, the employees stop pumping them out and move the bins into barn sheds and quickly close the door, and the other employees hide. If there are no disease problems on the farms, why are they hiding this part of their daily operations? Asked Morton. Morton successfully sued the Minister of Fisheries and Oceans Canada and Marine Harvest Canada after learning that fish later confirmed to be infected with Piscine Riovirus had been transferred into an open-pen fish farm operated by Marine Harvest in Shelter Bay, British Columbia. On May 6, 2015, the court sided with Morton and struck down agricultural license conditions that allowed private companies to transfer fish infected with viruses to open-pen farms in the ocean. And British Columbia will ban grizzly bear trophy hunting with a gaping loophole in this story by Merritt Kennedy of NPR, as found on the Earth First Newswire. A win for conservationists and environmental groups, British Columbia says it will no longer allow trophy hunting of grizzly bears in the Canadian province starting on November 30th. The new policy blocks all hunting of grizzlies in the Great Bear Rainforest, but still allows people to hunt for them for food elsewhere in British Columbia. Of the approximately 15,000 grizzlies in British Columbia, about 250 are killed by hunters annually, according to government figures. Forest Lands, Natural Resource Operations, and Rural Development Minister Doug Donaldson characterized that level of hunting as sustainable in an interview with Canadian Broadcasting Company. However, he says the decision to end trophy hunting is not a matter of numbers, it's a matter of society has come to the point where in British Columbia where they are no longer in favor of grizzly bear trophy hunts. This comes on the heels of an election win for center-left New Democratic Party, beating the more conservative Liberal Party for the first time in 16 years. The New Democratic Party had promised to end trophy hunting during the campaign, which the Liberals reinstated 16 years ago, according to the BBC. The grizzly hunting season is opening in parts of the province next week. According to the Toronto Star, many of the hunting permits had already been sold before the new government was formed. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can hear a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. during our Environmental Friday programming. You could also tune to WNMB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, where they rebroadcast our show from at 5:30 a.m. on Fridays. KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, broadcasts the show Wednesdays at 3 p.m. KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, broadcasts Saturday at 7 a.m. Or you can listen to WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill and Gilroy, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, and KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1. All rebroadcast the Earth First Update. Please check their schedule for the days and times. You can tune in to Grateful Dread Public Radio at gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 a.m., or you could go to radioforall.net, where you can listen online or download the Earth First Update anytime you want to, for free. That's radio4all.net. And I'd ask you to please check with your local nonprofit community radio station and ask them to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz. Please tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.